Hello, and welcome to a syndicated episode brought to you by the Comic Book Page Podcast. My name is John Mayer.
And I'm Bob Rutal.
The episode you're about to hear originally ran as episode number 27 of the Cryptographic Podcast. In it, Damian, Brian, and Bob discuss the latest Hellblazer trade paperback, The Laughing Magician. This episode was originally released on the Cryptographic Podcast feed on October 8th, 2008. Damian and Brian do a great podcast covering the horror genre both inside and outside of comics. If you're into that genre and aren't a listener of Cryptographic, hopefully the syndicated episode will encourage you to go subscribe to it. It's great stuff. Damian also does the Welcome to Heavenside podcast about the Dr. Sleepless comic book series, and if you enjoy that series, you really ought to check out the Welcome to Heavenside podcast. You'll be glad you did. These guys do great podcasts, they're good friends of ours, and I want to promote their show as much as I can, hence syndicating this episode that Bob was on, so our listeners can get a feel for what the Cryptographic podcast is like, and like I said, hopefully that'll convince you guys to subscribe to it.
Greetings, cryptographers, and welcome to Cryptographic, a transcontinental podcast featuring news, reviews, and interviews, and commentary regarding horror, dark fantasy, and science fiction. I'm Damien, reporting from Australia.
And I'm Brian, coming to you from the United States. Visit our portal with streaming audio and video at cryptographic.ning.com.
And visit our website at lordshaper.com/cryptographic for show notes and links related to each episode, along with a link to the Furnace Forums, which can be found at lordshaper.com/forum.
You can email comments to cryptographic@lordshaper.com or leave us a voicemail at 206-666-4734. And tonight, once again, we have with us Bob Bratel from the Comic Book Page Podcast, and he's making a return visit from, a few months ago. We were talking about Hellblazer and Swamp Thing and lots of different comics, but mostly Hellblazer. And the new Hellblazer trade, The Laughing Magician, had just come out, and we were able to talk him into coming back for a return visit.
It wasn't too hard to talk me into coming back. I love talking about any of this stuff, and all, you know, Hellblazer and a lot of this other stuff is stuff that John doesn't read, so you're not going to find us talking about Hellblazer over on the Comic Book Page show. John's not big on the horror kind of stuff, so if you ever want to talk about Gravel, I think you threatened to have me on to talk about Gravel at some point, too.
Could happen. Maybe, yeah. Do they have have they solicited the first Gravel trade?
I know no, they've solicited the Everyday Day, which is the the pre-gravel stuff. Yeah, but they haven't done the actual trade for that yet. I think that will be coming out next month.
Well, maybe when they solicit that, we'll have Bob come back and talk about the Gravel series and give people an idea of whether or not they want to order that trade, but. Tonight we're talking about Hellblazer. So this collection, Hellblazer the Laughing Magician, covers Hellblazer issues 238 to 242. I believe all of these issues are written by Andy Diggle, the artist Leonardo Manco, who I love from back in the day. And we were actually just commenting on how the Laughing Magician are actually Parts 1, 2, and 3 are actually the last three issues, and the first two issues in the trade, The Smoke and The Passage, the first issue isn't directly related to the story, and the second one probably should have been The Laughing Magician Part 0 or the prequel or something, because it does directly lead into the Laughing Magician story.
The Smoke also is not by Leonardo Manco as the artist. It has a guest artist named Danijel Zezelj. I'm probably mutilating that name, but I was going to mention that myself, but I couldn't pronounce it either.
You know, and now that I'm flipping through it, yes, it's actually much less scratchy, more angular art style than Leonardo Manco has, so that should have been more obvious, but I kind of crammed this down in one night because I just got it, and due to, you know, the, me being on the East Coast, you being on the West Coast, Damien being 12 or 14 time zones away, and, you know, having other podcasts and other, you know, schedule obligations, you know, we had to cram this in when we could, so I probably didn't pay as much attention as I should have, and that should have been more obvious.
But that said, it was actually a very fast read. I actually read it again last night, and I just chewed through them all. Like, I don't know if it was because I'd actually, you know, I knew the story already, but I was able just to read through them fairly fast.
Yeah, I agree with that. It was a pretty fast read.
But, you know, when you're rereading something too, especially you only read it like a couple of months ago, I mean, it's going to go a little quicker because you remember a lot of it. I know when I reread it, I kind of glossed over various things and, you know, didn't spend as much time reading everything as when I went through it the first time.
Well, this was my first read through, and I still felt it was a pretty quick read. Although, I gotta say, despite that, I kind of went back a couple of times because I felt like I kind of felt like I was constantly missing things. Whereas, you know, the last trade we were talking about, Joyride, I mean, I not only did I think I gush over it, but I suggested that it was definitely a good jumping on point for anyone who is new to Hellblazer. I am not going to be as gushing, and I definitely could not recommend this as a jumping on point. It's not a bad trade to follow Joyride with, but I definitely don't think I would recommend reading this without reading Joyride because you know, there are various parts of the story that refer directly back to the previous trade.
I certainly didn't enjoy this as much as the initial arcs.
Now, I'm just trying to remember, was Hunger Hill actually brought up in Joyride, or was that previous to that? That was the one thing I couldn't remember.
That was actually the closing story arc in Joyride. That was where they had that community where they were giving people homes, and then they were possessing other people's bodies and doing all kinds of stuff or whatever. Yeah. And it was that Hunger Hill community, and they kind of, you know, towards the end, you know, because I actually just kind of read the end of that story just to refresh my memory on it. And towards the end of that story, you know, John is kind of set up where that guy seems like he's leading him into, you know, the center of everything, and then it turns out he's leading him into a trap, and they blow up the development, and, you know, you find out that it's the minister of, I don't know if it's the finance minister or the minister of, the housing minister, was kind of like the ringleader of the whole process and everything. So, yeah, so you kind of see him and his magician, that Rinzen character. You know, a couple of characters that kind of come back from that previous storyline, but again, it's not overly obvious. I mean, they just kind of show up without much reference as to where they came from. And again, I kind of felt like there was a lot of that going on. Like, all right, we'll go kind of story by story. The first story is called The Smoke. And we have this... What does he call her? A naiad or a pixie or a nymph or whatever, or undine.
She's basically a water elemental.
Right.
A naiad.
Right. So Ephra, was she Is she a new character, or was she from a previous story?
I don't remember being mentioned before, but the name actually did, like, ring true to me. Like, I know the name from somewhere, so...
Okay, so, I mean, it might just be
a... Like, it could be actually drawing it from, like, a folklore-type thing.
Right, right. So, I mean, that didn't bother me a real lot. But what did bother me was when he's in the subway and he says, "All right, Map, stop playing silly buggers, I'm not in the mood." Who the hell is this Map character, and where did he come from?
Map's the spirit of London.
Well, where was that introduced?
That I can't remember. But
I don't remember either, and I had no idea where the hell this character came from that was, you know, that
so,
was...
the internet coming to the rescue. Ephra, I don't believe, was anywhere else in Hellblazer, but it is an actual river in South London. Is underground, and the name is derived from the Celtic word or Celtic word for torrent.
Okay.
And there was a project where people wanted to unearth the Ephra because it had been, you know, kind of built over. So it comes from reality.
Okay, so that's just the name of the spirit of the river, and the name is taken from the river. I mean, that's fine. But... like I said, how about this Map character that I never heard of before?
I'm just trying to find what he actually says his name is in there.
Not only Map, but then the Shadow Cabinet. Who the hell are they?
You got me.
Yeah.
I didn't read Hellblazer for about 10 years before I picked it up at the Andy Diggle arc, and I've since bought a lot of those, but I haven't gotten around to reading them yet. So they're.
Right, and this is
could be stuff that happened anywhere in there that I'm unaware of.
Right, but this is kind of what I'm getting at, whereas the last trade, you didn't have these kind of questions. Even though they were introducing new characters and new stories and whatever, you didn't and they referenced older stories, you didn't really feel lost or questioning. And like, it really actually kind of pulled me out of the story because I'm sitting here trying to think, now, am I supposed to know this Map character that John seems to be very familiar with? You know, he seems to be speaking in a very familiar way with. And, you know, and Map makes this reference to the Shadow Cabinet. And again, I'm sitting here trying to think. I'm like, is this something I'm supposed, a reference I'm supposed to recognize? Or are these, you know, where did this stuff come from? And it really jerked me right out of the story because I'm trying to figure out, you know, whether or not I'm supposed to recognize this stuff.
Taking that into a different direction for someone that hasn't been reading Hellblazer all along. So, I mean, this is how I think you can get different experiences depending on how long you've been reading Hellblazer. So you've been reading Hellblazer all the way along. This stuff comes up and you're thinking, wow, did I miss something? You know, since I haven't been reading Hellblazer all along, I got to it and it didn't bother me at all because I just figured, oh, well, you know, either I knew him or not. I mean, I haven't been reading Hellblazer. Within the context of the story, they did enough of an introduction of the characters that it just moved right along, and I didn't miss a step on it. So it didn't bother me at all. So someone who's picking up Hellblazer that doesn't have that lengthy of an experience with it, they might, you know, fall into that same classification where it might not bother them all that much.
Well, to be fair, I have gaps in my knowledge. I've read some of the Jamie Delano stuff because I didn't actually get into Hellblazer until the Garth Ennis run. And I went back and picked up all the Garth Ennis stuff and I read, I believe, pretty much all the Garth Ennis issues. I may be missing like one or two issues that I wasn't able to find. But I've read pretty much all of the Garth Ennis run. After that was Paul Jenkins. After that, I want to say maybe Garth came back for a story arc, and then Warren Ellis. And then when Warren Ellis left, I left. So after that, I think there was a Darko McCann run, Brian Azzarello and Mike Carey. And I didn't read hardly any of that stuff. We're talking about from around, I want to say 143, maybe around there, until I think around 201 I think I picked it up again, like, at the end of, is that my carries run? And then I dropped it again when Denise Mina picked up. So I have a little bit of a gap in the first, say, like 40 issues of Hellblazer, and then again from around, we'll round it out, to from around 140 to 200, and then I skipped that Denise Mina run, which is probably almost another year. So I don't have a comprehensive knowledge of Constantine's history, but I really didn't feel like, you know, again, I mean, very different impressions from two different readers, so, you know, anyone listening, you know, take it for what it's worth, but I didn't really feel like they established MAP at all. I feel like, you know, in one scene, he's saying, all right, MAP, you know, tell me what's going on, and you see the Smilers are at the gate on all the signs above, and you see the laughing faces on the monitors on the side wall, and then a couple of pages later, he's talking to some black guy. You know, like, oh, where the hell did this guy come from? You know, even if he made some kind of reference in a caption or something, like to MAP being, you know, the spirit of London or whatever, the spirit of the London Underground, something. If he made some kind of reference in a caption, I probably would have just accepted it as the introduction of a new character. But the way he came on so familiar to John, I felt like it was someone that I should have known and I didn't recognize, and that irked me. And then again, like I said, the Shadow Cabinet, that MAP references, again, it may be from a storyline that either I don't remember or I haven't read, but would have been handy if they made a passing reference to who they are and what they have to do with anything.
I don't know, because I didn't recognize the character myself, and I've got most, I think very soon I'll be down to about 4 issues remaining to get to finish my set. And I just took it as, it might be someone he knew of, you know, because since he's, at this point he's actually, you know, turned himself around from being, you know, everybody's lapdog, or, you know, the person that he gets kicked around every time something goes wrong, where he's trying to sort of turn himself into what he thinks he should have been or what he used to be. And, you know, he's just sort of realizing who all these people are. And he might have known of this person, but he'd never actually spoke to him. You know, it was just maybe that Map needed him for that point in time, and that was it. So he's never really had any other dealings with it, even though he would have known who he was.
Right. And, you know, I mean, not to belabor that point, because, I mean, that's about as much as you see of him on these 2 pages, and, like I said, in that reference on that earlier page. But, again, I mean, it just kind of pulled me out, because, you know, I didn't know where this stuff was coming from or what it may have been referencing. But the story, I thought, was kind of interesting, that there's this kind of shadow London.
But that concept's been around for a little while as well, because Neil Gaiman actually even brought that up with Neverwhere.
That's Neverwhere. I was just going to say that same thing. Yeah.
Sure. And
so this is a bit more violent than what Neil Gaiman envisioned.
Well, arguably, you know, isn't Harry Potter, don't they walk through a gate between the gates?
Yeah, it's just like the, yeah, it's the in-between places type thing, so, yeah.
In the subway in the UK, too.
Yeah.
And no, I haven't read any of the books, I'm just going by the movies, I don't know.
I've only got 1 book left to read.
Interesting idea, though, that, you know, these urban legends have a life in this shadow London, and these people stumbled into it, and John sent in to kind of pull them out. So, again, no, it didn't enlighten me regarding the human condition, but, you know, aside from the references I didn't get, I didn't mind the story. I thought it was interesting enough, and kind of ends on a, I don't know, melancholy note, I guess you could say. You know, not to spoil it too much for, you know, people who haven't picked it up or who want to pick it up, but, you know, almost poignant. But
it made a point as well. So like the whole point of this, what I got from this Shadow London is, it's every, you know, urban legend or something like that. It sort of has a life there because people propagate it by their belief in it, or they're, you know, telling their stories. And, you know, this goes back through every, you know, you look at Candyman and stuff like that. You know, we've all heard stories like that before the movie came out. So it's giving them somewhere where they actually live, which is this under London or Shadow London, which I really like the idea of.
I actually had been working on a story many moons ago, back when I used to have time to write, where there was a mythosphere, which kind of was a similar idea. It was actually partially inspired by Kid Eternity, if you guys remember that character. But like I said, I mean, not a particularly novel idea, but... I thought the approach was well done. The execution was well done. Not a bad introduction, but again, not having a real lot to do with the rest of the trade, probably included mostly for completion's sake, I'm guessing.
Yeah, as we said before we started recording, like, I think it's actually just put in there so you've actually got a continuous run of Andy Diggle stuff. Because we have the Jason Aaron's got done two issues actually partway through that, which I don't think are going to be collected at all. Or if they do, they'll be put in some collection with other odd issues like they've done with like the Neil Gaiman issues. Or was it the Rare Cuts trade? I think that was it.
I think there may be two trades. There was, I think, a Constantine trade that came out around the time of the movie that collected just odd issues, and I think it was included there. And I think there's a Neil Gaiman collection that has his Hellblazer issue along with, I don't know, like a Swamp Thing story and like a couple of other random issues that he did. I'll dig that stuff up and put it in the show notes. But I know, because that's one of the Hellblazer issues that I haven't picked up and is...
It's probably the
relatively pricey too. Yeah, besides being hard to find, relatively pricey issue too. So I'll probably pick up one of those trades eventually.
Actually, I was amazed. I got my issue at half price for $11. So I thought that was worth it for that issue, since you can't find it anywhere, you know, under $20.
And then we get into the next story, which is called The Passage, which, like I said, is pretty much a prequel for The Laughing Magician, which makes it the last three issues of this trade. And, it's pretty obvious that all of a sudden the art style has changed dramatically. Not for nothing, but I've been a fan of Leonardo Manco's art forever, so, you know, well, at least, I don't know, almost 15 years since I first saw him on Hellstorm with Warren Ellis. But I don't know. What are you guys thinking of the art from one issue to the next?
I definitely prefer Manco's art.
Yeah,
the
same thing.
The really loose style on the previous issue was okay. It was okay for a fill-in. I wouldn't like that to be the ongoing art. Whereas Manco, he's got a nice style that feels good for Hellblazer. You know, it's kind of moody. It's
what I've always put down to as vertigo art. It's like, this is what you've sort of seen throughout all the, you know, the old, I'll say the good old stuff from Vertigo, because I don't read much from Vertigo these days, but I used to read everything from Vertigo back in the 90s.
Well, I'm with you on that, but I'm not necessarily with you on whether or not this is Vertigo art, in part because my introduction to this was on Hellstorm and Druid, which were both Warren Ellis and Leonardo Manco, but that was also probably as close as Marvel has ever come and ever will come to doing a Vertigo book. But even aside from that, when I think of, you know, the classic Vertigo art, I think of Swamp Thing. I think of Sandman. I think Preacher. I think Transmetropolitan, which actually started as a Helix title.
Helix title. Yeah, that's the thing. That's the past Transmet as a Helix title. I don't class it as a Vertigo title.
I knew you were going to try and point that out, that, you know, it was actually about a year in before it became a Vertigo title after they shut down Helix.
Still chasing some of those Helix issues down too to finish my runs.
I see, and I got all that from the first issue, but anyway, so I mean, none of that was really doing this really dark, scratchy art that I could think of. Again, we're talking about Shade the Changing Man or Kid Eternity. I was just talking about or any of those other books, right?
Well,
definitely Invisibles.
They all had a similar feel to it. That's like it's just the feel of the art. It fits into that. That's where I sort of look at it and class it as Vertigo art. It's not from the actual. It's just the feel that I get from the art. You look at that and you go, "That's a Vertigo book." Even if someone opened it up and put it in front of you, you could say that's a Vertigo book.
I'm sorry, you were saying.
I agree with Damien on that because. I think a lot of those books that you named, if you laid the art right next to each other, I mean, they're certainly different art styles. I mean, you're not going to, like, Transmet, you know, Derek Robinson style on that versus the style you see on Preacher versus, you know, you look at Sandman and every story arc had different art,
different artists,
you know, from Jill Thompson to, you know, to Wheatley to all these different artists. And, you know, there's a general feel that you get out of a Vertigo, and maybe it's more of the storytelling that's captured in the art, but you get a certain kind of feeling out of the art, and I think that this certainly does kind of go along with that. We have very dark scenes in here, which you saw some very dark and disturbing scenes in Swamp Thing when it was really going along, right?
Sure.
And you saw, while not this kind of dark, you saw very darkly humorous and disturbing scenes in, you know, with Spider Jerusalem over in Transmet and Preacher. You know, you can't look at Dylan. I mean, his art style is very clean and, you know, all that, but I mean, he had some really warped stuff going on in Preacher, right? So.
Right, and I think that's kind of where I'm sitting on the opposite side of the table from you guys because, well, yeah, all of these stories had dark happenings, if you will. The art styles were typically much cleaner. They didn't have all of the scratchiness that Leonardo Manco's art has. The pages themselves, like especially in the trade, because the trade is on, I think, maybe a lesser paper stock than the single issues. Are the single issues on, like, that shiny paper?
No.
Oh,
they're
okay.
They're still the old, yeah, the Vertigo paper.
I almost feel like the pages are a little oversaturated and are at times almost too dark.
Actually, the one person whose art I think reminds me, or this reminds me more of, would be Guy Davis's stuff on Mystery Theater.
Okay.
Because that had that sort of feel to it as well.
I was almost entertaining Sam Keith or Bill Sienkiewicz, but and Sam Keith did the first arc in Sandman. A lot of people don't remember that. Everyone just knows the Max.
Sam Keith's run back then, he had a little bit of the style, although he's a little more Kelly Jones-ish.
Yes.
And I would compare him to Manco here, but I can see Sienkiewicz having similarities.
Sure.
To this.
This would be a very toned down Bill Sienkiewicz, a less abstract Bill Sienkiewicz, or a
More early Sienkiewicz, because I mean Sienkiewicz, you know, he morphed into that really abstracty kind of style over time.
Sure, sure. I mean, he started out like Frank Miller started out as like a Neil Adams, Jim Aparo kind of influence, and then, you know, they morphed into their own styles. But did you see Bill Sienkiewicz and I don't even know if he penciled or if he inked the those Black Widow miniseries from a couple of years ago. That art is probably relatively close to this, where it was much more toned down from the borderline abstract art that he does sometimes. It was much more toned down because, you know, he's doing Black Widow. He's not doing, you know, some Bill Sienkiewicz thing. But, yeah, I mean, it wasn't like even like the Demon Bear or something, which was which I love that art, but that, I think, was probably way farther off the rails than what Leonardo Manco is doing in here.
Well, one thing, I kind of shifting gears a little bit, but not completely, one thing that really does set the tone for this and some of the other Vertigo stuff, but it's the color palette that they use. It's a very washed, almost monochromatic palette, you know, with different color themes for the different pages, but you look at any given page and it's predominantly a particular color theme, maybe with a little bit of something with some highlights. You look at this first issue here, the 239, we start out and it's mostly red tones. Yeah. You know, get a little more inside the hut here, but then you go into some, you know, twilight kind of coloring, then you get a yellow page. Actually, it goes on for three pages with a predominantly yellow tone. Then you're shifting into an orange predominantly. You know, but, you know, that's very different thematically. And this is maybe what sets it more apart for you, Brian. But, you know, you look at like a Preacher or a Transmet, something like that. And those are kind of standard coloring where everything's, you know, got its own colors and stuff. And it's not that... what's the film style? Almost, it's
sepia?
Not as dark as noir, but yeah, it's almost like something that's done in kind of a sepia, you know, type of thing where they're going for the subdued color tones.
Sure, and I think that may in part be attributable to design sense, whereas books like, you know, Preacher or Transmet or The Invisibles had, for lack of a better term, conventional comic book art. This is definitely, I mean, if you saw a superhero book like this, except for maybe, I don't know, maybe some Moon Knight stuff or something, like you wouldn't expect to see this on, you know, Batman or X-Men or Spider-Man or something like that. Like, I mean, if someone opened up a Spider-Man comic and saw this, they would probably be, you know, cursing Quesada, cursing Quesada more than they already do. But I might have to pick up that issue. But say, you know, you had Derek Robertson or Steve Dillon or who was doing The Invisibles? I don't even remember now. But But you know what I'm saying. One of those types of artist, you know, could very easily transition from from the Vertigo books they were doing to a superhero title, and no one would pitch a fit. Whereas, you know, Leonardo Manco's art style, besides the fact that it's, you know, it's more exaggerated.
Okay, the first series of The Invisibles was done by Phil Jimenez.
Okay, yeah. I don't know if he did all of it, but he probably did most of it.
I don't know if he did all of it, but...
I think he did most of it, and I think Brian Boland did the covers for most or all of it.
I've just got issue one I've pulled out. This is issue one of volume two, so...
Manco is almost, I want to say, maybe a better comparison would be Simon Bisley. Again, you know, somewhat...
Less angular.
somewhat reined in Simon Bisley.
Yeah.
Although I just picked up... I just got in my recent Heroes Corner shipment, The Dead, which is Alan Grant, Simon Bisley, and somebody else. I don't remember. And,
that's the,
you know,
Lobo,
yeah,
team together.
Yep. And, you know, because everyone loves zombies, it's a zombie comic. And I think maybe Glenn Faber did the cover, even. You know, when I opened it up and I saw the art, you know, I recognized it was Simon Bisley, but... again, it's very much kind of pulled in. It's not like some of the crazier Simon Bisley art or some of the more out there Simon Bisley art. But yeah, so anyway, so back to Hellblazer. We've covered the history of comics for the last 10 years, you know, alternative comics, or somewhat alternative comics.
Now, what did you guys think, actually, for the fact that John didn't show up until the last page? What did you even notice?
Didn't bother me a real lot, I gotta say. I was getting into the setup of the story.
Yeah, I was carried along by what was going on. I mean, it was pretty intense from page to page.
Yeah. It just sort of started off, like, you know, slowly giving you some idea about, you know, this laughing magician, and then sort of just started barreling along as, you know, you wanted to know where it was going.
I love this page and a third splash. It's not a two-page splash, because there's those panels descending on one side, but there's a page and it kind of leaks over onto the other page splash of the guys with the Mako. With the
hyenas.
Yeah, I was going to say hyenas, jackals. And, you know,
there's a baboon there as well, if you have a look.
Right, all chained up in front of them. That should be a damn poster or T-shirt or something. That's an awesome shot. But, yeah, and then mayhem ensues. And it was interesting how they're kind of, again, you know, they introduced new characters and, you know, new storyline, new setup or whatever, but I didn't feel jerked out of the story like I did on the other one, because, I don't know, it seemed like maybe they were going more out of their way to set up the characters and establish them, whereas in the other one, they just seemed like they were dropped in the story and references were made, and it wasn't maybe as obvious a setup, but whatever. Anyway, so they set up this story where, as you said, Constantine isn't really seen until the last page, and it's kind of funny where you have this guy, he's carrying this message, you know, overseas, and, you know, he has this, like, singular vision, almost like he's possessed, where he has to deliver this message, and John just happens to get it at the end of the issue. I thought it was a good introduction to the Laughing Magician storyline. There was definitely some of the outre elements that you expect to see in a Hellblazer comic. They're earning their mature readers' warning on the cover. You know, if they got to be lit, they might as well earn it, right? And you know, it was a bit of a clever idea that they didn't elaborate on too much, with the, you know, putting the message in that root.
In that root, as it was.
Right, right. He puts the dream in that root, so when the other guy eats his brain, he doesn't get that knowledge, although he does detect the gap in the knowledge, which is interesting. But, you know, so, I mean, definitely some interesting ideas put forth and a good, I feel, setup to the Laughing Magician storyline.
But I just like, there's some of the things in there they didn't even need to put in, but they did anyway. Like when you saw them stealing the Jeep, as they had the woman sort of just diverting the news crews that were sitting there watching these people basically just die, sitting there eating and, you know, drinking and smoking cigarettes while they had nothing to eat. But the fact that it turns around and says, leaving her behind, they head east. For the first time in his life, the boy experiences air conditioning and chocolate and bottled mineral water. It's like, you didn't even have to put that in there, but it added so much to the story as it was going along, showing how little they actually have.
Yeah, how do you feel about that, John? I almost kind of felt like they needed to pad 2 pages because Constantine wasn't showing up until the last page.
I don't know how John feels about it. Bob.
Oh, Bob. I'm sorry, Bob.
I was waiting to see if someone would say that or not.
I can tell you how John would feel.
He'd probably be grossed out.
He would have passed out on the page with the shaman's head with the top chopped off of it and the guy eating his brain.
The brain eating.
Yeah, but we hadn't got up to that one yet.
Yeah, well.
I didn't feel it was padded. I thought it was an interesting take on the story.
It's like it's showing that they are doing really, a bit of a journey there. That's not that they're just sort of appearing in front of John type thing. It's sort of like they've got a long way to go, so it's showing the travel to where they what they have to do to get there.
Right. And I do like the fact that even though he gets killed, I mean, the guy actually did outsmart, he did hide that away and he sent it away. So he kind of knew what was coming.
It's funny too, because, I didn't think of it until just now, but Leonardo Manco drew a story not entirely unrelated to this in the mid 90s, again, with Warren Ellis in Hellstorm, where there was a magician who was killing other magicians and using their organs to make magical armor. And it's interesting because I didn't even really pick up on that until just now, where you have this magician killing other magicians and eating their parts of their body to get their magical knowledge. But that was kind of the same idea where he was. In the Hellstorm story, he was killing other magicians and making this armor to incorporate their power into his own. But I guess it was just a little more excessive on on Warren Ellis' part, in Hellstorm. Whereas in this, I guess there's precedence for that, where you would have, I want to say it's a Native American thing, but it's probably also an African thing, where they would eat the heart of their enemies to gain their courage, that sort of thing.
I think that happened all over. That's come from way back, that. So I think there was even Celtic references going through that, going back when I was doing some study on that. So, but you notice that we never got to see the boy again? He got into the cargo ship and that was it. Then we don't see the boy again.
Well,
wait a minute.
I only just noticed that.
did the boy get on the ship or was he left at the camp?
No, he was in the car with them, remember, when they drove off.
Okay, no, you're right. It says they drive until they exhausted the spare fuel cans, sell the Jeep for passage north, keeps the passports, he barters them for passage on the cargo freighter for England, and, lose the boy somewhere on the boat.
Unless there was a few people in the cargo ship, and it's just that they're focusing on him because he tried to get to John.
One way or the other, we still lost the boy somewhere around,
somewhere
between one port and the other.
And then we go to,
interesting, I don't know if he was trying to make a, I don't know if it's necessarily a political or a topical reference, where the guy, he delivers this root with the magician's memory as he gets shot, and in this panel he says, I told him to drop it. Shit, it's not even a gun, just a harmless old tree root or something. So, it sets up this whole thing, and there's kind of a reference in the next issue to, I'll jump into the next issue here, where he says, that armed response copper paid you to make this disappear, didn't he? The proof of his incompetence, mistaking an old tree knot for a gun. And then he says, last thing the Met needs is another IPCC investigation into the shooting of yet another non-white immigrant. Scares off the tourist. So, I don't know if he was trying to make a political or a topical reference there, but that definitely, coming from New York and knowing of a number of shootings where it turned out the person wasn't armed or, it's usually a minority, and, things like that. That kind of struck me as, an interesting point.
But also, this could be John doing his bargaining thing as well. Like, he wants something from this guy, so he's going to use everything he can to get it from him. And if that means blackmail, he's going to blackmail him, so...
Oh, no doubt. Constantine's manipulating him, or at least pointing out that, he doesn't really owe this guy much because he already collected from that cop for making this evidence disappear. So, for this guy not to make it like he's doing Constantine too much of a favor or that he hasn't already been compensated for this favor. So, there's definitely that element, but there were probably less political or topical ways to achieve the same effect. So I kind of feel like, that was just a point that he was trying to bring out in the story. Andy Diggle was trying to bring out in the story.
I think a lot of this kind of stuff also just kind of seep into a writer's, you know, subconscious, because you see stories like that in the news all the time, and it just kind of comes out.
Yeah. Oh, sure. I don't think he was necessarily referencing one particular story, just commenting on the fact that these things happen.
Yeah. Well, I think it's just like, that's kind of these kind of things happen, and it's just like, it was a good way to, you know, have this guy whip out this tree root to give to John, and, you know, boom, he gets shot by these paramilitary.
It's a convenient way to take him out of the story, too.
Yeah, you have to worry about him wandering around. Well, plus, he can't be questioned, right? You know, it's like, it heightens the sense of mystery if, okay, well, he delivers the thing, but, okay, he's dead now, so. Not only do you not have to deal with them, but that's no longer a source of information about who gave you this, where did this come from, what were the circumstances, all that, which he could have answered to some extent.
Yeah.
Right, which then leads into the next
part
of the story.
Just look, on that topic, he didn't even believe about it until he was handed the root, and the root basically told him, this is what you have to do. Like, he got to see what was in there, or he got to see part of what was in the root, part of that dream and what was going to happen, that he knew that he had to do it. There was no, and it seemed to sort of like possess him as far as, well, from what I could tell. It was like he was just either driven by he had to get this done, and there was no other way around it.
Well, back to what Bob was saying, taking out this character, besides, you know, thinning out the cast, it also sets up the next part of the story where he goes to Song's place and he has her seer look at it and figure out what it is and what he's supposed to do with it. And then, you know, that's the point where he figures out how he's supposed to use it, or what he's supposed to do with it, and what the message is. And again, you know, back to what Bob was saying about the palette, you see this kind of red wash over the first couple of pages going into Songs. And then from there, we see there's a page and a half of kind of a blue wash.
Yeah.
And then it's back to yellow when he goes inside the root, so to speak. And he communes with the dead magician, who tells him that, you know, that Mako is hunting for him. Again, I think that's kind of a little bit of Leonardo Manco's design sense, that he tries to evoke a mood by using these washes of color over the pages rather than using a more traditional, coloring style.
And even as it shows, like, it's showing the difference, like, when he's been shown the past and stuff like that, from when there was always a Life of Magician, or there was always a Constantine, you can actually see that going through there with, you see that he's walking there, he's got the yellow around him, and then you've got the washes around them for the different pasts.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you definitely see this kind of purplish, and then this greenish blue, and, yeah, it's all different colors for different periods. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a awareness of the usage of color, and a specific use of color in this book.
And the only actual past Constantine I actually recognized was Lady Constantine there. Did you guys recognize any others?
No, but I don't know that we were necessarily supposed to. I don't know that John was even necessarily aware of it up to this point. It almost seemed like the dead magician was telling him information that he didn't know, but he should know.
Yeah, which is also setting it up for us as well. So,
sure, arguably it's an info dump for the audience, but again, didn't feel like that while I was reading it. It's maybe a little more obvious in retrospect.
And then it sort of cuts over from that to actually having the plane landing, which sets up the end of the book. Yeah.
You kind of wonder about, it's like, it was dramatic and all, but it's like, okay, does this guy really need to slaughter everybody on the plane to the point that think of actually crash land sort of on the runway? You know, it's like, how are they even guaranteed they're going to walk away from something like that, just like, show a little bit of restraint. I mean, let the pilots land the plane if you don't have anybody that knows how to fly. That whole scene just seemed kind of weird to me.
Well, going on the theory that we've actually seen of him, like, I was under the idea that he might have actually eaten the pilot's brain, so then he had their knowledge of what to do with the plane.
Just not complete, huh? Obviously didn't land it very well.
He's too busy killing everyone else.
I think that may almost be an argument against that theory. You know, besides the fact that we didn't see it, arguably if he ate the pilot's brain, he probably would have a more complete knowledge of how to fly the plane. I think it's more likely that, you know, as they got into British airspace or close to the airport, he just started hacking into people. But again, it's kind of weird to figure out how much time did he have. Yeah, I mean, he had to be reasonably close to the airport to, you know, they had to basically be in descent in order for the plane to land in any capacity at the airport. And somewhere between the beginning of the descent and the crash, he slaughtered the entire plane.
Well, the other thing is, he could be using his magic to actually just control the plane and get it down. You know, he could have just slaughtered everybody before they took off. Then decided that, you know, and basically used magic to power, you know, to run it to get him from point A to point B.
Why not just take a magic carpet at that point?
It doesn't look as good when it crashes and gives you more victims at the other end.
I suppose.
Now, for those who actually have been reading that with the issues, that was actually the 20th anniversary issue as well. That was issue 240.
Right, and I think in this month's previews, they're soliciting issue 250, which I think is I know it's an oversized issue. I don't know if it's double size or what.
It's 48 pages, and it's got numerous writers, and that's just going to be short stories, I'm assuming.
As a matter of fact, let me do a quick check on it.
It's on page 240 of previews. Oh, sorry, 120. Yeah, you've got Brian Azzarello, Jamie Delano, Dave Gibbons, China Maleev, Peter Milligan, and art by Eddie Campbell, Rafael Grandpa, David Giuseppe something.
What I wanted to check on is that actually was one of our picks for the month to have a special discount from DCBS. So if you want to highlight that one of you guys for the previews episode.
Did you see my list already?
I don't remember. Is it on there?
Yeah, it's
you can
on there.
Mention that there's a special discount.
Okay.
Talk about.
I'll be doing that either tonight or tomorrow night.
No, but that one, that actually looks like it'll be a great standalone issue that somebody can pick up because it's just going to have, I mean, a real all-star cast of writers and artists.
Yeah, and that may be the point where I jump back on the monthlies because reading the last trade and this trade, I really feel like the gap between the trades really kind of worked against it, especially as we work our way towards the end of this trade and they start directly referencing elements of the previous trade. I think if I was reading it monthly and, you know, not, I don't know, 6 months or so apart, or probably not that much, maybe 3 months apart, you know, if I was reading it consistently, I probably would have been you know, it would have been more directly in my mind than, you know, being so far apart. But we're getting to that as we're moving along here. All right. We have Constantine pulling off a little magic in the wellspring of misery. It's funny. He says, Mako's magic is a particularly fucked up degeneration of Muti, fueled by blood, pain, and misery, which means if I'm going to mask myself from him, my own cloaking spell will need to draw from a similar source. If it's blood, pain, and misery you're looking for, Mayday A&E on a Saturday night is pretty much the wellspring. So he's in the emergency room, surrounded by all this misery and pain and suffering, and he's using that to cloak himself from Mako's similarly blood, pain, and misery-fueled magic.
But as it goes on there, how it actually states that the spell wasn't working, or someone else already cloaked him. Now, we didn't get any resolution on that, do we?
No, I kind of interpreted that as when he went on his magic carpet ride with the dead magician in the tree root, that that was a kind of a side effect of that, or that it may have even already been in effect, or may have been transferred when he when the root was passed on to him. You know, that that cloak may have been passed on along with it. Now, that much I took for granted.
Because it's sort of, it's like it's introducing another party into what's going on here, but you never get to see them. And that's the way I was looking at it, like someone, there's another player here that we don't know yet.
That's possible too, but, you know, again, I'd be surprised if he, if the dead magician had, you know, transferred this message from Africa to England and didn't bother, you know, passing along a little protection. What do you think, Bob? Reading too much into it?
I didn't analyze it that deeply. I just kind of like read it, and it's like, oh, okay, someone's cloaking him, and this went on. In fact, I almost made an assumption that it was Ms. Song, since it went from that scene to, you know, Ms. Song, and she's there, and you got the guy who's like, oh, I can see him, the war mage is coming. So I thought maybe she did something, since John had been talking to her last issue, that maybe she did something to cloak him. You know, I wasn't looking for, you know, big extra meaning to it.
Well, then on the next page, and the next couple of pages, we get the idea that, you know, she can't even protect her own seer, so it's unlikely that she was protecting Constantine. Even from their conversation, didn't seem like she would necessarily be inclined to offer him much in the way of protection. She almost reluctantly offered up her seer.
But then again, if he wasn't actually looking for him, then he wouldn't have been seen by him. That's the other thing too. So she's had him there looking to see what was going on, and basically she's found him.
Another interpretation of it, which is kind of the one that I was operating under, was what would have led, this is a guy, Mako, right? What would have led Mako here anyway? I mean, they don't have the tree root, do they? I mean, or do they?
No. John's still got it.
John's still got it. So what would have led Mako to Ms. Song's place?
It could be following the trail of it. You know, it could be that that's leaving a... Like, because he's got the memories, he's basically following wherever it's been.
Right. And I was kind of like thinking maybe that because they were helping John, that there was some residual trace that was causing him to be led there. Again, just my interpretation when I read the story, I was just thinking, okay, maybe if they are doing something to help mask him, that is part of the problem of what led this guy to them.
Possibly. It could also be that, you know, the seer, like I said, again, lends credence to the idea that, you know, if Song was going to protect anyone, she'd be protecting her seer, and most likely wasn't protecting anyone. But the seer kind of opened himself up. We'll say, and I'm guessing the pronunciation's Mako, like the shark. I'm not sure. I mean, it's hard to tell from a book what the proper pronunciation is. But I'm guessing that he was trying to follow any kind of psychic energy that that's maybe, we'll say, tuned to a specific frequency. We'll say, you know, even if, you know, he didn't know necessarily that there was a root, he knows... We'll say more or less what kind of frequency the magician was operating at, and he's looking for some kind of, you know, trying to follow some kind of psychic trail, and maybe that's what led him to him. I mean, again, you know, it's once you throw magic into the mix, is, you know, any attempts at logic kind of you know, get thrown out the window. So I mean, you could hypothesize all day long, but you know, may not necessarily get you anywhere, but I'm guessing, yeah, you know, he opened himself up to being found as soon as he touched that root and use his power over it. Then they get killed, and...
I like the way that Mako is using his actual power, too. He just picks up that bullet and just splits it in half to actually have the guns backfire.
Sure. A little sympathetic magic by way of James Frazier, who wrote a book called The Golden Bow, for people not getting that reference.
And I like how the fact that he decided that it was going to be easier to jump off a building than to get caught by this guy.
Or preferable. preferable to die when you hit the pavement rather than be tortured to death and eaten by this, this, how is he referred to?
War mage.
War mage, yeah.
I'd like to see what he would do against Gravel.
Would be an interesting meetup.
But the fact that his leg's hanging on by a thread, by what it looks like, or is it the actual, just the jeans themselves are holding his bottom half as his leg, as you see him jumping off there?
It looks like he is, like, right up against the edge, and his arms are kind of on the edge there in the middle panel, so it's almost like he just kind of used his arms to kind of, like, lever himself up over.
Yeah, he just kind of pushed himself off the roof.
Yeah, I don't think he would have been able to physically leap off using his legs, given that, in fact, on the bottom right panel, it looks like that piece of leg has completely come off. It doesn't look like it's even there.
Yeah.
Yep.
And then a couple pages in, we see Constantine having a fry-up and a pint at 4 a.m. in a diner, and he says, if Mako got to the shaman, he has his memories now, all but the ones the old fella hid in this tree root. There's a hole in Mako's mind, and this is the only thing that'll fill it. He's connected to it now, which I'm guessing means that if he's connected to it by way of the shaman, then he's able to trace anyone that it comes into contact with.
Yeah, so here's where he tumbles to the fact that he's holding a tracking device. I really like what he does with it, though. That's funny.
Oh, yeah, it's kind of classic. And again, reference to the prior trade paperback, Joyride, where essentially the bad guys drive off at the end of that story. And so he mails it to the bad guys, and Mako finds it and does what he does best. Naturally, he starts by killing Rinzen, and he says, Rinzen can't help you now, old man.
I just like how it was addressed to the Hunger Hill Skydivers Club.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, sure, because they all jumped off. He had all those people jump off the roof at the end of the last storyline. So, yeah, so the Skydivers Club.
And it's just at that point when he clues on that something bad's going to happen as the boot goes through the door.
How long has it been here? How long since this morning? Uh-oh. We're screwed. But he doesn't do what he does best until the next issue in quite lengthy and horrific fashion.
Yes, I was going to say in a drawn-out and explicit fashion, but one description's as good as the other. he doesn't actually kill Rinzen right away. Rinzen tries to get a shot in before he gets nailed down, so to speak. And it's interesting because as he learns that, he's been tricked, the ringleader, pulls his ace out of his sleeve and says, "Oh, hey, I got the information you're looking for."
Yes, this is something I'm still waiting for it to actually continue on, actually what happens in the end of this trade. So, like, through the issues, we're still waiting to see where this, everything's going to come back and bite John.
You see, this is the other thing that kind of set me off as we're getting back to the end of this trade. Now, a little clever bit where he says, the laughing magician, the constant one, you mean Constantine? Now, that was clever because I didn't pick up on the constant one, the laughing magician, the constant one being related to Constantine. That was kind of clever. But then where he leaves off, first off, Again, was it established previously in continuity that he had a stillborn twin?
Not that I've seen. Not at all.
Yeah. Again, it's another bit of retroactive continuity that I was unfamiliar with and kind of jerked me out of it. And then from there, I almost kind of feel like the end of this story isn't really the end of the story, but the setup for the next story. And again, I haven't read any of the following issues, so I don't know.
Well, I can tell you now, we're still waiting for this setup to continue. So there's been no mention of anything about the twin. There's been no mention about this pact that you have between Mako and the guy from Hunger Hill. There's been nothing yet.
Okay, and this was...
And where I've got like...
242?
242, and I've got 247 sitting here to read.
Right.
And isn't again, he on the book to 255? I think that's when Diggle gets off. 250, I think it's 255. I know he's getting off soon, so...
I don't know, but I'm not a big fan of introducing the beginning of another story at the end of a book. You know,
like, from reading it from the issues, I don't mind that, but the fact that I would like to see it actually continued in the following book, and it hasn't continued yet, unless this is just something that's going to build up. Like, he thinks that he's beaten everybody, and he's set his enemies against one another, and he's free to go now, and it's all going to come back and get him and put him back into the state that was created by Garth Ennis back in the day. You know, after he's wormed his way out of being, you know, this failing wizard, if you really want to look at him that way.
No, I'm also not necessarily a fan of what I'll call sitcom continuity, where they start a story and they take a character to, you know, one situation or another, but then they have to resolve everything and bring the character back to where he was at the beginning of the sitcom because... You know, there's another episode, and they need to maintain the status quo.
Yeah.
You know, I like the fact that they kind of reinvigorated John, and to leave this dangling plot thread in the background so that at any point they could, like, come and crash down on him and just undo everything that was done, you know, since the beginning of the last trade kind of makes the last trade and this trade almost feel worthless. So I hope that's not the direction that they're going in.
As far as I know, Simon Oliver's taking over? Oh,
I don't know.
I can't remember.
Following.
I have a feeling it's Simon Oliver. Now, he's actually writing the Chaz miniseries at the moment. I have a feeling he's actually going to be taking over for Andy Diggle.
I haven't been reading that. How's that?
Not too bad. I've read three issues into it now, and yeah, basically, what is it? The whole idea is there was like a demon that was trapped within London, and all the actual roots of the that all the cabbies know and things like that. That was actually the way they did their roots was originally the spell that helped contain him, and so literally what's happened is this stone has actually been broken. By, you know, people that were moving it, it's like the London Stone or something like that. It was actually broken while they were actually moving it from one place to another, and that's let this demon out, who's possessed one of the kids, who's found out what this knowledge is and all these roadworks, which means he goes from point A to point B, and the end of each point is actually where something was buried, and he had to do a spell there or something to actually get... you know, to basically free himself and to bring the end of the world type thing. But I like how, like, every once in a while, like, you've got Chaz running around trying to do all this stuff, and it shows John on holidays in Ibiza every once in a while. So he's sitting there drinking daiquiris and, you know, going to bed with people, and, you know, it shows, like, two pages of him just having fun while the world might possibly be ending.
I don't know. So far, I'm not inclined to pick it up, but I'm glad you're enjoying it.
It'll be out as a trade. It'll be out as a trade. So.
Oh, no doubt.
Yeah. Unless you're like me and has to have everything Hellblazer, but get it as a trade.
Yeah. All right. So overall, I'm pretty mixed on this. I liked elements of the story. I had problems towards the beginning and the end of the trade, but I liked a lot of the middle. What did you two think?
I thought, being a five-issue trade, and I know Vertigo likes to churn the trades out like there's, nobody's business, but given that you didn't get much of a resolution at the end of the story here, it would have been nice if they could have thrown in the next arc and made it instead of a five-issue trade, done like a nine-issue trade. How many issues is the next arc, Damien?
Just give me a second. I don't think it's that many, because you've got two issues by Jason Aaron, but I don't think that they'll trade that with, and that ain't just finished, so that would have been 45 and 46.
You could have easily put those two issues in on the end of this.
Yeah, so, well, even the fact you could have put 43, 44 in with it, because, that's really a standalone thing on its own, if I remember right. I'm just pulling up my list now.
Right, but what you were saying is, that doesn't add anything to the story either, right?
Well, the 45 and 46, the Jason Aaron stuff, is going back to issue 11 and revisiting what happened in Newcastle.
Right, but I'm saying even the two issues prior to that don't have anything to the story either, right?
No, that's basically a new story is on its own. Yeah.
Certainly not, but it would have made it a little more...
A little
more satisfying as a trade to be seven issues worth of material than five, though. I mean, five just seems kind of thin for a trade. Now, I didn't buy the trade, so I don't know what you feel about it. As monthlies, it's doesn't really matter.
Sure, but even monthly, when I get to the end of an arc, I like to feel that there's some kind of conclusion or resolution. And like I said, even at the end of the last trade, even though you kind of see the bad guys drive off or whatever, you feel like the situation has been resolved. Yeah, the minister kind of drives off, but you kind of have that feeling like, he's almost untouchable and there was nothing you could really do about that. And I don't know. The ending of the last trade just felt like more of a conclusion than this one. This one really feels like almost like a cliffhanger. And then to find out that the cliffhanger isn't even addressed, any time in the next couple of issues, like you can get a whole another trade in from the sounds of it and not get any reference to the story, let alone a conclusion to, now you have essentially two enemies of Constantine, supposedly plotting against him. And, Mako, the whole reason he came to London was supposedly to kill and eat John Constantine, and he goes on holiday?
Well, he's found out that he can actually draw on the powers of hell now because of this other guy, so he's going to have all the souls in hell to actually draw his power on, all the pain and suffering from there, because that's what he runs on. But there's nothing being done about it so far. It's like...
Well, I just looked at it. I'm just the two guys. They're both back in issue 247. I just pulled it off my stack here. I haven't read it yet, but Lord Merlin and Mako are both back in 247. But given that this thing only ran through 242, right? I'm thinking 243, 4, 5, 6. That's only four issues. Doesn't seem like they'll get a whole trade out of that.
Yeah, because the only difference I can see why they wouldn't have put 43 and 44 in is because Leonardo Manco isn't on the art. It's got Giuseppe Camacoli or something like that. I've never butchered his name there. He's the actual artist on 43 and 44. And we know that, they really don't like splitting royalties between two writers. If you've got, Diggle and Aaron doing it, they won't actually really put their... put them in the same trade. But the Newcastle Calling, if you haven't seen that, that's 45 and 46. That was a really good story. I have to admit, even though I've been loving what Diggle's been doing, I thought this was better.
Yeah, I didn't read them, and, I don't know. I'm kind of on the fence with whether or not I should be trying to track down all these individual issues that may or may not be collected, because then what do we have? We have two... Andy Diggle issues, then two Jason Aaron issues, and then what, maybe another three Andy Diggle issues before 250?
Well,
something like that.
I'll tell you what. If you were going to start reading it monthly at 250 anyway, I'd recommend starting, you know, right after the end of this trade, picking it up, because they should still be floating around on the racks. And that way you'll get those Jason Aaron issues, which I agree with Damian are really good issues. And I'm not convinced that, especially if what Damian says is true, if they don't like cutting royalties between two writers in a trade, they might just skip over those and not collect them or something.
Okay. Diggle's last issue is 249.
So somewhere between 247 and 249, maybe he's going to wrap this up?
Yeah, so probably what you'll see is another five-issue trade that has the 43 and 44, and then the last three issues. You'll have another five-issue trade.
Right, so they'll leave the Jason Aaron issues uncollected along with the Mike Carey issue
between
Denise Mina and the Diggle run.
Yeah, so, I mean, like I said, you might want to just start getting it monthly right here at the end of this thing. You can start reading the story on from where this trade leaves off.
Well, again, you know, sounds like a good idea in theory, but I'll tell you, when I used to go to my local shop weekly, and now I go semi-monthly, depending, you know, if I'm looking for something, and I still get a couple of issues at my regular shop, like All-Star Batman and Robin, because it only comes out a couple times a year anyway, so I'll make a trip over to the shop, and I'm actually due, because I think it came out last week. The only issue of Hellblazer that he used to order was the one he used to order from my pull list.
Yeah.
He didn't order it for the shelf, and I don't know that anyone else had it on their pull list. So,
I'm sure you'll be able to find it on eBay or something.
MyComicShop.com is your friend.
Sure.
I've just put another order in from them, actually, since the last one disappeared.
And you won't even have the Damien problem, since you don't live in Australia.
Yes. I waited 2 months for a shipment that didn't arrive.
About a week and a half, you should have the books, you know.
What got me is suddenly they had the books, all the books that I ordered came back into stock because they were on my want list. I got an email saying they were back in stock. So I think it had been sent back to them.
But, you know, getting back to this, you know, and the ending in particular, again, reminds me of something that Damien and I were talking about with Lock and Key from IDW, the Joe Hill book. I was really, really disappointed with the last issue of that book because I know a big thing with you is you hate a first issue that's all set up. Well, I hate a last issue that's all set up, and that's what I felt the last issue of that first Lock and Key miniseries was. I felt the end of that story ended maybe halfway through the book, and then the second half of that last issue was introducing a bunch of new storylines that are maybe going to be addressed in the next 2 6-issue miniseries that he's talking about. And I hate that. And then the audacity that they're selling that, I think, as a hardcover. If I bought that as a hardcover because I heard everyone ranting and raving about Lock and Key online, and I get to the end of the book and they introduce like 3 or 4 storylines that are going to be resolved in another book.
That'll come out in like a year.
Pissed to high heaven.
Yeah.
I would be pissed to high heaven. I mean, I don't know. I mean, even when we were talking about it, I was kind of mixed on the first issue because I didn't really feel like I got a lot from it, but I felt the second issue was a lot better. But then when I got to that last issue, I was like, what in the hell? How are you even going to introduce all these new stories and then cut off the book? I don't know. How did you feel about that?
It didn't affect me that markedly. I mean, I look at the miniseries, since I know another miniseries is coming, I almost look at it like it's an ongoing series. You know, it's just like, to some extent, kind of like Fear Agent or something, where it's like a series of miniseries. And, you know, just setting up the next story arc. So it didn't I agree with you that I didn't like the lack of closure at the end, but it didn't send me that out of control. So
I didn't go flying off the handle. I mean, I was ranting and raving online about it, or even on the podcast or anything about it. But and I wouldn't even 100% say there was a lack of closure. Like I said, I kind of felt like the closure came relatively early in the last issue, because then they needed to set up all these storylines for the characters. And I think that's what really bothered me. I think if they had, you know, just ended, you know, ended the story like halfway through or something, or, you know, found some way to pad the story or something, just to where if it ended with some sense of closure, and, you know, first issue of the next story introduced all these new storylines, and you had all the characters, you know, going into their new situations or whatever, I would have felt better about it, because, okay, there are a bunch of familiar characters that were set up in the last miniseries, and now they're all going into these different directions or stuff. But to introduce the characters going into all these different directions in the last couple of pages of the book, and then say, okay, in a couple of months, you know, you can buy Lock and Key number one, maybe. I mean, I don't know. That's been a while, too. I don't even know when that's going to come out. I haven't seen any solicitations for Lock and Key 2 number 1, so I mean, I don't even know when that's coming about, but I'm not a big fan of being left hanging, especially when I'm paying for the privilege. We have a couple of minutes left before Bob has to go. Pigeons from Hell is another one that Damien and I were talking about, where a lot of people seem to have liked the book, and it had all the elements that would kind of lead me in that direction, because it's based on an old Robert E. Howard story. It was adapted by Joe R. Lansdale, who's pretty well known to, you know, readers of horror novelists, as well as a number of horror comics that he's done, and I'm a fan of his stuff. So, plus, I think he wrote the script for Bubba Hotep, so, you know, even movie fans could kind of get in on that bandwagon. But for me, I didn't love what he did with the story. I didn't love his interpretation of the story, and the artwork really didn't work for me at all. And so I was pretty well disappointed with that. And then, interestingly, I bought the Roadkill Zoo trade paperback, which kind of tread along the same lines. There were a lot of elements of Roadkill Zoo that kind of reminded me of that. Primary difference being Pigeons from Hell is more of a ghost story, where Roadkill Zoo is actually a zombie roadkill story, if you can imagine. But same kind of Cajun Creole Louisiana setting and that kind of element, you know, the voodoo element and stuff like that. Abandoned plantations and stuff like that. But I felt that Roadkill Zoo was much more entertaining on a number of levels, from the story and the artwork. And that was, I don't even remember the name of the publisher. It's some small publisher. It's the first book that I bought from them. And like I said, unfortunately, I don't even remember their name. But, you know, Pigeons from Hell was from Dark Horse. And it's Joe R. Lansdale adapting Robert E. Howard, and I don't know where they dug up the artist from, but I really didn't care for him, and I was even disappointed in the story. So, you know, there's no safe bets. You know, I know some people say, you know, they prefer to buy from, you know, DC or Marvel rather than an independent, or they rather, you know, go with a creator they're familiar with than with someone they never heard of before. But, I mean, here's a perfect example. I bought a book from creators I never heard of before, from a publisher I never heard of before, and had a much more satisfying experience than buying a Dark Horse book by Joe R. Lansdale. So there are no absolutes. Any other closing thoughts, Bob? Because I know you got to run.
You totally missed me on those. I didn't read either of those last two books that you're talking about. So,
well, I think Pigeons from Hell is available as a trade, and I would recommend skipping that. And I know Roadkill Zoo is available as a trade because I own it, and that was a trade, not an original graphic novel, because I remember the solicitations for the original issues. But, again, I hadn't picked them up, but I had seen stuff online that led me to believe that I would enjoy it, and I did. So I would say if you're interested in zombie roadkill, that, you know, if that seems like an entertaining premise to you, then I would definitely go with Roadkill Zoo. Definitely entertaining and interesting story.
I'm going to say it doesn't sound entertaining to me, so I'll probably skip that one.
No, they did some clever things where, like, you know, you have these zombie rodents kind of, not necessarily zombie. I mean, they weren't, like, you know, slow lumbering
possums and squirrels.
Right, right. They were. Right, because they were a little bit more Land of the Dead than Dawn of the Dead, if that makes sense. You know, they were a little faster and a little maybe more 28 Days Later than Dawn of the Dead, if you will.
It'd be the remake of Dawn of the Dead, where the zombies were faster.
Right, right. Yeah, they were definitely faster and more menacing than slow and lumbering, but. You know, they did, like, interesting things, because when you have, like, rodents and stuff that can get into small places or can get under a car and chew on cables and things, and there were just a lot of situations that were set up and played off that I thought were interesting and clever. But, you know, I'm far from the mainstream, so take from that what you will. All right, Bob. We won't hold you up anymore.
Yeah. No problem. I was glad to talk about it. I'm really enjoying the Andy Diggle run and the Jason Aaron. I'll echo what Damian said. The two issues from Jason Aaron were really, really good. So I've been
I had heard they were.
I've been liking a lot of what he's been doing on, you know, a lot of different books lately. So Jason Aaron is.
He's doing Scalped, right?
He does Scalped. He's doing Ghost Rider over at Marvel. Yeah. He's doing...
All Ghost Rider needs is a new artist.
Yeah, that artist is awful.
And I saw in the latest previews, he's still on there, so I don't know if I'm going to keep getting it. The only thing that's keeping me getting is Jason Aaron's writing.
Yeah, I mean, comics are a visual medium, and I can read, you know, something by a weak writer drawn by, like, Alex Ross or something, a lot easier than I can read some wonderful, you know, Jason Aaron thing drawn by that guy.
I don't know if you, like, I've been a big fan of, like, the Midnight Suns and that, as people probably know, but I didn't even recognize Blackout. And Blackout is one of the main villains throughout that whole Midnight Suns, Morbius, and, you know, back in Ghost Rider, the Danny Ketch days of Ghost Rider as well. And you can't even recognize the character. You know, it looked like some, I don't know, bizarre girl with flats in her hair.
I don't know. I ditched after the first Daniel Way story arc and never looked back.
Well, that was a wise thing to do, Daniel Way. The weakest part about what Jason Aaron's doing on Ghost Rider is cleaning up the wreckage that Daniel Way left in his wake.
Yeah, I know. That's the primary reason why I didn't pick it up with Jason Aaron. I probably would have come back if not for the fact that he was left with the situation that Way set up. And I've heard good things about the Jason Aaron run, but I just can't get around it. I just can't get around the central conceit. So, you know, it's kind of like, you know, if we can't get past the central conceit of a reanimated roadkill or Ghost Rider being an angel, then it doesn't really matter how good the rest of the book is.
Yep.
Yeah. And, Bob, where can you know, people find where you are on the net?
www.comicbookpage.com. We do a weekly show where we review one Marvel, one DC, and one or two indie books. And we do a preview show once a month that Damian, you're on all the time. And Brian, you're certainly welcome to be on anytime you want to record a submission for it. We do creator interviews as part of the preview show. We do the Mayo Report where John and I analyze the top 300 comics that are out from Diamond. And then John does a version of that with Chris Marshall from Collected Comics Library where they talk about the top 100 trades that came out from Diamond.
Yeah, those Mayo Report episodes are I enjoy the review shows, but I really appreciate the insight that you get in the Mayo Report episodes. There's really good information about the sales trends in the industry in those episodes.
Yeah, and they're just ask John for some of that data sometime. I go over that Excel spreadsheet with him each month, and it's the amount of information in there is staggering. And it's not even a complete data set. You know, that's what some of the detractors have to say. It's like, oh, well, it's completely invalid because it's not complete. You know, because, of course, not all comics are sold through Diamond. There are other sources of comics being out there. But, I mean, it's largely accurate. I mean, most comic books are sold through Diamond, through shops. And the trending that you get from it is in large part accurate. So it's just fascinating to see how, as an example, putting a zombie variant cover on a Marvel comic book automatically would add 5 to 8,000 extra copies of that book. Just consistently. Boom, boom, boom. We'll have to see on these 8 variants. I'm kind of hoping that they don't get that kind of a kick so Marvel will get that out of their system.
Well, I've been tempted to pick up a couple of those, but only just because I'm friends with David Yarden, and he's done a lot of them.
The only one I saw that was even tempting was the Punisher one, where he was jumping down, and he had a gun in both hands and a gun in each of his prehensile feet, and he was shooting all 4 guns. That one was clever. The other ones were not.
Okay, well, that should be all for us today. So remember to listen to visit us at lordshaper.com/cryptographic and email us at cryptographic@lordshaper.com. And you can go to myspace.com/cryptographic or find Brian and myself at myspace.com/radiofurnace for me and myspace.com/hellstorm_KGK for Brian. We're both members of Facebook, and actually Bob's on there as well, so you can find Bob on there as Bob Bretol. You can find me as Damian Smith and Brian as Brian Matus. There's a fans of Cryptographic group on there as well, and there's also a fans of comic book page as well, so join up with those. So there's a couple of groups you can join up with if you can find them in the new Facebook, but I'm not complaining about that. You can follow us on Twitter, where I'm twitter.com/lordshaper, Brian's twitter.com/hellstorm, and Bob is twitter.com/comicbookpage, if I remember correctly.
That is correct.
Yep. And you can call us on our new voice line since we lost the old number because I didn't ring through enough times in the month. It's 206-666-4734. So leave us a message on that. And, hey, yeah, we're always open for messages. We want to try to get some sort of feedback show going at some point. So we've got a couple there at the moment. So as soon as you actually get through, we'll add them to it. So other than that, we'll talk to you guys next time.
Peace.
And that wraps up this syndicated episode of the Comic Book Page Podcast. My name is John Mayo, and I've been your host. If you have any questions or comments, my email address is podcast@comicbookpage.com. Thanks for listening.